Welcome to the Director's Chair, a Lowy Institute podcast. My name is Michael Fawley-Love and I'm the Executive Director of the Lowy Institute. On the Director's Chair, I sit down with political leaders, policymakers, and commentators in order to understand what's happening in the world. My guest on this episode of the Director's Chair is an old friend of mine, Jake Sullivan. Jake is one of the most impressive people I know. He's held positions of trust for many of America's leaders in the past two decades. As senior policy advisor to the last two Democratic presidential candidates, Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden, as deputy chief of staff to Hillary Clinton when she was Secretary of State, and as national security advisor to Vice President Joe Biden. He has many high-placed admirers. The late American diplomat Richard Holbrooke predicted Jake would be Secretary of State one day. Hillary Clinton is said to have told friends he could be president. Barack Obama called him a once-in-a-generation foreign policy talent. Jake and I first met at Oxford, where we were both studying international relations, and I was very pleased to bring him to Australia in 2017 as the Lowy Institute's Distinguished International Fellow. Everyone wants a bit of Jake's time at the moment, given his role on Vice President Biden's campaign. And if Biden is elected president in November, we can be sure that Jake will again be a very senior player in the United States government. So I'm very grateful that Jake has taken the time to speak with me on the Director's Chair, direct from Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Welcome, Jake.
Thanks for having me, Michael. It's great to hear your voice.
All right, let's start with your background. You grew up in Minneapolis, part of a big Irish Catholic family. What did your folks do, and what was it like growing up in the American Midwest?
So my father worked for the Minneapolis Star Tribune, which is the major newspaper in Minneapolis, and not as a reporter, though. He was on the business side of the newspaper, and my mother worked in the Minneapolis Public Schools. She was a teacher and then a guidance counselor, and ultimately ended up at the high school that we all went to, although after I had gone there, thank God.
And I've teased you in the past about being Minnesota nice, which is a stereotype that people sometimes apply to that part of America. But your hometown of Minneapolis has been in the news recently for less than nice reasons. And I'm referring to, of course, the killing of George Floyd by a member of the Minneapolis Police Department. Did that event and what followed change your views on racial inequality in Minnesota and indeed throughout the United States?
I wouldn't say that event changed my views dramatically, although they certainly cast everything in much sharper relief. And, you know, the emotional reaction so many of us had to 8 minutes and 47 seconds of a knee on the neck leading to the death, the murder of this man. I mean, it's hard not to have that have a huge impact on you, not just emotionally, but intellectually too. That being said, when I was growing up in the 80s and 90s in Minneapolis, in the Twin Cities, I went to a high school that, you know, was about 50% white and 50% people of color. And yet I did not fully grapple with or grasp the systemic racism in our country. I didn't understand or comprehend the extent to which especially young Black men face the danger of simply walking or driving while Black and the ways in which the criminal justice system so badly mistreated them. I didn't have a full grasp of that growing up. It took me until many years later, actually working in policy in DC, to look back upon my own community and see the shortcomings and the weaknesses there. And so the George Floyd thing didn't open my eyes to that. But, you know, as I said, it certainly drove it home in a way that was as powerful for me as it was for so many people across the country, both people from Minnesota, Minneapolis, and people from cities and towns everywhere in the United States.
All right. After high school, you did your undergraduate study at Yale College. And I remember you were attracted early on to foreign policy. And I think you were an intern for Les Gelb when he was president of the Council on Foreign Relations. You won a Rhodes Scholarship to Oxford. You attended Yale Law School. You did a clerkship at the Supreme Court. And from there, it was straight into politics. And you served as an advisor to Senator Amy Klobuchar, who's another familiar name. And by 2008, at the age of 32, you were working on Hillary Clinton's first presidential campaign. Now, Jake, you've often been the youngest person in the room when big decisions have been made. And I remember a few years ago when Kevin Rudd said at an event that you were very young to be Clinton's top policy advisor. And you joked that in the dog years of a campaign, you were actually about 80. But let me ask you, why have all these leaders, do you think, been willing to listen to you at such a young age? Where do you get your intellectual confidence from? And have you ever suffered from imposter syndrome?
The answer to the last question is definitely yes. I have frequently been in rooms and thought, does anyone quite recognize that I am not qualified to be here? Maybe if I just stay quiet, this will all pass okay. You know, the great Minnesota poet, in fact, Nobel Poet Laureate Bob Dylan, who's from a small town in northern Minnesota, a proud product of my home state, has this line in a song of his. He says, "How much do I know to talk out of turn? You might say that I'm young. You might say that I'm unlearned." And I thought about that a lot. Like, what does it mean to talk out of turn? Does somebody in their 30s working in national politics or on big foreign policy issues almost by definition talk out of turn when they try to contribute to the conversation? And then I realized, you know, everybody suffers from imposter syndrome. Virtually anyone who has, you know, a reasonable dose of humility and perspective, we all have to recognize that politics and policymaking, you know, as I've said before, it's imperfect people with imperfect information facing imperfect choices and getting imperfect results. And so as long as you are willing to recognize that there are many things you don't know and seek out advice and guidance from others, as long as you are willing to give it your best shot, but also be honest about the limitations of your perspective, as long as you're willing to listen to other people and acknowledge the strengths in their arguments, as well as the weaknesses and blind spots in your own, you can really belong at any age. And I developed a kind of confidence that said, I do have something to contribute here. And it's a message I give to a lot of young people now. Now, one thing I have noticed in government is that young men are much more likely to do that than young women. Young men are like, of course, I belong here. Of course, you know, if I have 2 out of the 10 skills necessary for a certain position, then, you know, I'll pick up the other 8. Whereas young women frequently think, if I have 8 out of the 10, I need to get those other 2 before I can sit at the table. And I think that is what is somewhat, to use a clinical term, messed up about the way that policy and politics works in the United States. That is changing. I think a lot of us are recognizing the extent to which both men should maybe check themselves a little more and women should be empowered and lifted up to a greater extent. But I think this young person issue actually does have a gender dimension to it that has kind of reinforced sexism in the national security community in particular in ways that are deeply corrosive and that I think a new generation is waking up to and trying to remedy. I didn't mean to take us kind of veering off there, but I think it's an important point to register in the context of your question.
Another line from the Minnesota poet Bob Dylan was, "You got to serve somebody." And for a big chunk of your career, you were serving Hillary Clinton. So Barack Obama beat Hillary Clinton in the 2008 Democratic primary. Then he beat John McCain in the general. You guys probably thought you were on the outer, but then Obama appointed Clinton as his Secretary of State and you joined her at Foggy Bottom. What can you tell us about Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State and as a boss? You traveled with her, I think, to all 112 countries she visited as sec state. What was she like as a boss? What was she like as a foreign policymaker?
She was a phenomenal boss. Just an unbelievably kind, generous, empowering, encouraging boss to everyone. Whether you were a grizzled 30-year veteran of the Foreign Service, or you had just come on board as a, you know, a young strap hanger aide, she looked you in the eye, she asked you questions, and amazingly, for a public figure, she listened to your answers, was genuinely interested. And what was so striking about going to the State Department with her is everybody across the board at State had a kind of preconceived notion of Hillary Clinton because she'd been in the public eye for so long. And uniformly, they would say, "Oh my God, I had no idea she was that way." You know, so that's as a boss. As a diplomat, I think 3 things really stood out to me about Hillary. The first is that she recognized the kind of politics in any diplomatic situation. She could relate to other leaders, understanding their political constraints, their political calculus, and I think it made her more effective. The second is that she recognized that diplomacy can't just be practiced in kind of fancy rooms with the flags and the wine and the cocktail parties and so forth, that it fundamentally had to be or had to have a substantial people-to-people dimension to it as well. And I thought she was a uniquely effective communicator in that respect as chief diplomat. And then the third thing about her is that she recognized very much that in order for the United States to be effective in its foreign policy, we needed to integrate all elements of power, and that civilian power, diplomacy and development were just that, elements of power. And we're about advancing interests and not just being nice and doing good things and saying the right thing. And that sense of power, I think, made her a strong and effective steward of American foreign policy in a way that sort of interestingly balanced with the part about her being focused on people. And to kind of bring it home, I used to joke with her that she was one of the rare people who could get up in Vladimir Putin's grill the same day that she was like holding an orphan baby, you know, and be equally comfortable in those two scenarios. That's a highly rare quality for someone in the role of Secretary of State.
Well, given she was such a personable and impressive character, what is it that drove the Clintons' opponents so crazy? I mean, I remember in 2015, you were caught up in all this when you had to testify at length before the US House Select Committee investigating the attacks in Benghazi. There's a lot of madness in American politics, but with Bill Clinton and also with Hillary Clinton, there seems to be something particularly toxic about it. What is it, do you think?
Well, I think it's distinct for each of them. You know, I think with Bill Clinton, there was a certain political elite in the early 1990s who looked at this, what they saw to be, you know, a good old boy from Arkansas coming in to disrupt and to, you know, not have the manners and the right bearing and the right way of being. And I think that had a big impact on how the media ecosystem, the Washington establishment kind of perceived and received Bill Clinton. With Hillary, I think gender had an enormous amount to do with it. And it goes back to the 92 campaign and to a decision that was taken by the conventional wisdom purveyors that she was not fulfilling her role as candidate spouse and then as first lady the way she was meant to do. And so what's so interesting about Hillary Clinton, and I do think this comes down to gender, is that anytime she is doing a job, the later years of being first lady, being senator from New York, being secretary of state, she was enormously popular among Democrats, independents, and many Republicans. Her approval rating as secretary of state at points was in the 70s. Anytime she was seeking a job, running for a job, she was vilified. She was looked at as totally calculating and something's wrong with her. What's this woman all about? What are her motives? And I think that a huge amount of that comes down to the fact that she was seen as an ambitious, uppity woman. And it ultimately was the difference between her being able to be an exceptionally successful public servant and a far less successful presidential candidate.
All right. When you were serving Hillary Clinton at the State Department, you undertook the early secret negotiations with Iranian representatives on what later became the Iran nuclear deal, or the JCPOA. Speaking about imposter syndrome again, or going back to that, what was it like to be undertaking those missions? Did you feel in some small way you were bending the arc of history?
You know, it's so interesting. Participating in that, you sort of think you're part of something larger and more historical, but your concerns are so much more prosaic. Like, can I not screw this up, please? You know, can I just get through it? And not, and in fact, when Bill Burns and I went off for the second meeting, the second session that we held, President Obama actually said to us, I just have one piece of presidential guidance for you. Don't screw it up. And so you sort of lay awake at night thinking, God, am I taking this in the wrong direction? What am I missing? What aren't I thinking of? And as a result, you sort of lose a little bit of perspective about the arc of history or the sweep of history, and you get much more focused on the nuts and bolts of the negotiation, how you make sure you're battening down every hatch, you're dotting every I and crossing every T, particularly when it comes to a nuclear negotiation where the details really matter. And so when we finished the interim deal and it was announced to the world in Geneva in 2013, Prime Minister Netanyahu went out and said, you know, this is a historic mistake. And I remember looking over at my colleagues and saying, you know, I don't think he's right. I feel pretty good he's not right. But you know, was this a historic mistake? No, it wasn't. Was it? Please, no, right? And you think it's just so human. And that's the thing more than anything I try to communicate to people is even grand acts of statecraft are just fundamentally human. It's human beings without a lot of sleep trying to work their way through difficult decisions in which neither side is going to get all of that they want. But what you're really trying to do is make sure you get what you need. And, you know, when we would call President Obama and say, okay, we think we're there on some issue or some piece of the deal we wanted to agree to, he would turn around and say, well, do you recommend we say yes to that? Boy, when the President of the United States says that to you, and you either have to say yes or no, and you can't just say, well, you know, you're the one with the Oval Office, you have to decide. It's enormous pressure, and it's a sense of responsibility that is a little bit hard to convey or communicate, but it really does remove you from this notion that, oh gosh, look at me, I'm part of something mm-hmm. really important and historic. It's a much more nerve-wracking kind of experience.
All right, in 2013, you left the State Department, you joined the White House, and you became Joe Biden's National Security Advisor. Let me ask you, first of all, about your observations about President Obama's worldview. And what do you make of the arguments that Obama was too passive in the world, too willing to accept the thesis of American exhaustion, too willing to accept external constraints on his actions rather than creating facts on the ground through American power? Is there any truth in that?
You know, my biggest objection to that line of argument is that I think it takes a particular case, mm-hmm. and that case being Syria,
yeah,
really, and extrapolating it to an entire foreign policy. And I just don't think you can map the unique circumstances of Syria onto Barack Obama's foreign policy writ large. So, for example, and I'll come back to Syria briefly at the end of this. For example, it was Barack Obama who stood up in 2011 and declared the pivot or the rebalance to the Asia Pacific, which was an affirmative, serious mm-hmm. undertaking to reallocate American forces to the Pacific, to lift up American diplomatic and economic engagement in the Asia Pacific, and to recognize and respond to the rise of China as a legitimate, serious challenge. If you look at the way in which he set the agenda on major initiatives, whether it's the Paris Climate Agreement or the Iran nuclear deal, and drove really affirmative outcomes in both of those cases. In most of the ways in which Barack Obama looked at the mark he wanted to leave, from arms control and nuclear proliferation to climate change to stopping the Ebola epidemic from becoming a global pandemic, he was a person of resolve and action, and had a serious view that the United States had to be a significant present player. I think the red line ended up becoming the thing people mm-hmm. used to define aspects of its foreign policy when it was such a unique circumstance. Here was a president who had run on ending the war in Iraq, who had just dealt with a difficult, challenging, and deeply uncertain set of outcomes with respect to Libya, who was now being asked to get involved in yet another military conflict in the Middle East. And the decisions he made there, I think, were really unique to that circumstance and don't really say as much about his engagement more broadly with the rest of the world.
All right. You sat in the Oval Office each morning for the president's daily intelligence briefing when you were Vice President Biden's National Security Advisor. Tell us about that experience, and how do you feel about President Trump's apparent lack of interest in such matters?
This was, you know, one of the most remarkable experiences that I've had in public service was the opportunity every day to sit with a small group of 7 or 8 people with Barack Obama and Joe Biden. They sat in 2 chairs opposite the rest of us, the National Security Advisor, the Chief of Staff, the Homeland Security Advisor, myself as National Security Advisor to the Vice President. And the way it would work is intelligence professionals, either the director of national intelligence or his deputy, would do a briefing in which he would lay out the key intelligence developments from the previous day. And then President Obama and Vice President Biden would pepper him with questions. They'd already read the physical materials. Then they would leave, and we'd spend about a half an hour talking through significant policy developments, larger trends that we could informally go through together that, you know, didn't necessarily rise to the level of a formal National Security Council meeting. And then some element of what you might call like seminar room discussion mm-hmm. of the rise of China, or how we're going to modernize our alliances, or how we're going to make that breakthrough to Paris. Unbelievable. And what was amazing to me is how President Obama and Vice President Biden were so dialed in to the micro, mm-hmm. okay, what is that intelligence report on that issue and what do we have to do with it? And on the macro, you know, what are we missing in terms of big picture themes or trends, and how do we make sure we stay on top of them? And the gap between that and what we have reportedly with this president, how he won't read, he won't listen to his intelligence professionals, he won't engage in serious substantive dialogue with policy advisors. You know, it's sad to me as somebody who has sat in that office, sad to me as someone who so deeply respects the American presidency, but it's mostly sad to me as a citizen who sees the results of it in a kind of aimless, very personality-driven, erratic foreign policy.
All right, tell us about Joe Biden's foreign policy instincts, and how is he similar to President Obama in his outlook? How is he different from Obama?
Well, I think one of the biggest things about Joe Biden that is distinct is that he sees this moment today in the world as different from the world that Barack Obama and Joe Biden walked into in 2009. So, for example, one of the things that he has emphasized very heavily in the foreign affairs article he wrote and the major foreign policy address he gave last year is the way in which democracy around the world is under duress, both from within and from without, and how rallying the world's fellow democracies to effectively deal with authoritarian competitors and with transnational threats and with the weaknesses inherent in, you know, our own systems today is for him such a central theme. And that is a very different kind of emphasis than what you saw back in 2009. Second thing about Joe Biden that's different. So that's kind of more on the policy worldview perspective. In the actual practice, the craft of diplomacy and policy, Joe Biden is tactile. He believes fundamentally that, you know, Tip O'Neill is a famous old Irish American politician, had a phrase, all politics is local. Joe Biden quotes that line and says, you know, all foreign policy is not just local, it's personal. It's about relationships. It's about looking the other guy or gal in the eye and getting the measure of them. He believes that quite passionately, to a greater extent than President Obama did. And so I think if he is elected president of the United States, he will be a relationship-driven president. And that goes for friends, developing deep relationships of trust with allies and partners, the leaders of those countries. It also goes for competitors and even adversaries. You know, he has spent many, many, many hours in the same room as Xi Jinping. I have accompanied him for some of those meetings. And he cares deeply about knowing what makes Xi's mind tick, how he is seeing things, probing him on issues. And he has an appetite for that that is boundless. And that is, you know, something you don't see that frequently from American leaders. You didn't see it as much from President Obama as you would see it from a President Biden.
Let me ask you about a 2014 comment by Bob Gates, Obama's defense secretary. I think he was unhappy with the vice president at the time. Reportedly, he said that Biden has been wrong on nearly every major foreign policy and national security issue over the past four decades. Do you think Gates was unfair?
Yes. I think he was absurdly unfair. I mean, that is a preposterous statement. You know, Joe Biden was a driving force in the Congress behind a number of the key arms control treaties. He helped get past the Chemical Weapons Convention. He was a leading player in helping stop the genocide in Bosnia. And on the particular comment that Bob Gates made, I think a big part of what motivated that comment, I'm obviously not inside Secretary Gates' head, a person whom I respect enormously, by the way, although I think he's just totally wrong on this. I think what was driving him there is he was deeply frustrated with Vice President Biden because they tangled over the decision around adding tens of thousands of troops to Afghanistan in 2009 and 2010. Biden thought that was a bad idea, that we should narrow the focus of our mission to counterterrorism and not get engaged in a grand counterinsurgency approach. Gates wanted the sign-off from the vice president for his preferred plan, which was, you know, 30 to 40,000 additional troops. On that particular issue, which I think spawned a lot of this, you know, the desire of Gates to call out Biden. Biden was right and Gates was wrong. You know, I think the history has proven that we would have been better off as a country if we had followed Joe Biden's advice in 2009 with respect to Afghanistan.
All right. In 2015, you went back on the campaign trail as the senior policy advisor on Secretary Clinton's presidential campaign. And when you read the memoirs and books that were written about that campaign, there's a lot of mud thrown around by participants. at everybody on the campaign, I think, except you. And you seem to be the one person that escapes this criticism. And people remember you worrying out loud about the campaign's inability to connect with working class voters. Obviously, you've had a lot of time to reflect on that campaign. When you look back on it now, how is it that a character like Donald Trump was elected president?
So let me start by saying that normally when somebody escapes the criticism and everyone else on the team gets it, you can normally point to them as being the source for all of that. But I can sleep soundly at night. I can look you in the virtual eye and say, that was not me. Yeah. I'm not sure. I don't read those books, by the way, because honestly, it's still pretty depressing. So hard for me to read it. But just a word on the issue of where I think the campaign in part went wrong. You know, we didn't find a strategy that allowed us to win a sufficient number of voters in the upper Midwest, in the states of Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania. And that ultimately was the difference in this election. My mom is from Wisconsin, a small town Wisconsin. Many people in her family were Democrats who became Trump voters. So I was sort of seeing this trend unfold in real time. And I think a couple of things were at play here. One of the big ones is that somehow the combination of a series of different elements came together to make enough voters believe that Hillary Clinton was just as bad as Donald Trump. So it's not like people loved Trump. It's that they basically, you know, Hillary got enough bricks put in her backpack to slow her down, drag her down. And the real story of 2016 is less that Trump rode a wave of, you know, popular support to the presidency. And it's more that there was an effective teardown job of someone who I think is one of the most admirable women in American history. And so I don't think we should overlearn the lessons. But I do believe that Donald Trump was able to connect to white working class voters on some pretty basic arguments, some of which are not particularly attractive arguments. Arguments around immigration, for example. Arguments around how the rest of the world has just, you know, ripped off America and they're all a bunch of terrible losers and so forth. So he had some points to register that those folks had not been hearing from either party. And that had a particular resonance and salience, particularly with certain people in the upper Midwest.
That concludes part one of my conversation with American policymaker Jake Sullivan. In part two, we discuss the Trump administration, Russia, China, alliances, climate change, Australia, and of course, the presidential election in November. Join me for part two of this episode of The Director's Chair.